transparency. Thanks so much.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature People's Movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KABU Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KABU is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about registration, endorsement, childcare, or on the Pacific Northwest Social Forum in general can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And on the Radio Zine today, we feature excerpts from a recent Portland panel discussion on the need to ban landmines. The event was organized and introduced by Lynn Braddock, an advocate with Handicap International. She lost her son, a U.S. Marine, when his team accidentally detonated a cluster bomb in Iraq. Ms. Braddock has spent time in Laos, one of the most heavily cluster-bombed contaminated countries in the world. The panel also features a retired American fighter pilot who was ordered to drop bombs on Laos during the Vietnam War, a retired Air Force officer whose job duties included making sure the war in Laos remained secret, and a representative from Handicapped International U.S. The panel was held at the First United Methodist Church in Portland last Thursday. Here is Lynn Braddock of Handicap International.
The whole purpose of this is to get people aware of the situation, aware of the weapons that were used by the U.S. government, the weapons that are still in the arsenal of the U.S. government, and to get the public to not only be aware, but to push to not use certain weapons. I wish we could push to stop war, but maybe that's not possible. But we can say there are certain things that we refuse our country to use on other countries. And any weapon that continues to cause civilian harm years after the war is over, in the case of Laos, it's 50 years, and only 1% of the munitions have been cleaned. A little bit about me. My name is Lynn Braddock, and I was brought to this work with the loss of my son in Iraq to a U.S. cluster munition. It's been an amazing journey, and I have learned a lot. And I've seen a lot, and I've met the most amazing people. So as hard as it's been, it has been such a blessing, such an awakening. And I'm thankful for every minute I've had this work. What we'll be talking about tonight is specifically Laos, because it is the anniversary of 50 years since the first time the U.S. dropped cluster bombs on that country. I don't know how many of you know about Laos. It was called the Secret War. I did not know about it. I did have brothers who did know about it. Laos was declared like a neutral zone. That country, no one was supposed to engage in war on that. But the U.S. bombed a total of 9 years. They bombed the country 24/7, so 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And during that time, they dropped 270 million cluster bombs on the country. Now, a cluster bomb is like a big bomb, but it's loaded with what they call tiny little bombies. Okay, this is a giant shell or rocket, and it's loaded with tons of these little bombies, and inside these are loaded with tons of little barbarians, or little pellets. My brothers know exactly. So as these come down, they twist and they arm, and when they strike, they're supposed to explode. Well, that did not happen in many, many cases. And so when they didn't explode, they hit the ground and they lay there. Now, this is quite a delightful looking little thing, and as you can imagine, very attractive to children, as well as others, like, what is it? And of course, you play with it. So if it wasn't armed as it came down, you pick it up and you move it, you do arm it. And once that click happens, it blows. And so it can lose an arm, a leg, both an arm and a leg, or it can cause a death. Anyway, we bombed Lao, we dropped these on them. As at the end of it, there were 84,000 of these laying throughout the country. So my purpose was to sort of document this. People who've suffered with this have become my friends and partners. We're a group called the Ban Advocates. What we're doing is we push to ban, there is a treaty now, to ban the use of clusters. The U.S. absolutely will not discuss the banning of the use of clusters. But the other thing we're pushing for, which we consider a very small step, is banning the use of landmines. And the U.S. is the only one of two countries in the Western Hemisphere to not sign the landmine treaty. We just recently, however, in Maputo, said the Obama administration is now taking steps to begin the process to join the landmine treaty, which is huge. Just to say that, the reaction has been very disgusting in some members of Congress saying we're jeopardizing our security to make a statement of that type. But that's the way it's going to go. And so it's where we have to push. We have to push our senators, our representatives to like, no, this is so, we haven't used it in 19 years. There's no reason to continue. You're here for several reasons. You're here so I can tell you about the situation. I am here to get you to sign the petition to join the landmine treaty first. That'll be our first step. And right now there is a fundraiser where all the money raised will go to the Lao people, and it will be matched dollar for dollar until the end of the month, up to $250,000. The next person that will be speaking will be my friend Patrick Weary. And I think Patrick, with what he'll be saying, will be a really great example of how life can change some of the way, the perspective that you might have. Patrick?
My name is Patrick Weary, and I just want to tell you a little bit about me growing up, what I did, and we'll talk about that a little bit, and I'll be open for questions and so forth. Way back when, I grew up in California, normal kid, oldest of five. At age seven, I saw my first Navy airplane. It was like the little duckling or the little gosling who imprints on the mother. He says, whoa, there you are. It just imprinted on me. I knew from age seven what I wanted to do. Long story short, that's what I got to do. I got to become a naval aviator. It was a struggle to get there. It was competitive. It was hard. And I just wanted to fly airplanes like crazy. And I got to do that. One fine day, I launched, I launched off the USS Enterprise, the largest and only nuclear-powered surface warship at the time, in a attack fighter plane. This was during the time, this was 1969, Nixon had just been elected, Henry Kissinger was our new Secretary of State. Their objective was to try to somehow negotiate an end to this thing. It was had been a downward spiral. We had 500,000 American in Vietnam at that time. Nobody was doing well. It was pretty obvious. So just to set the scene a little bit, Kissinger was trying his darndest to get the North Vietnamese to sit down at a table someplace, sometime, and talk about how can we get out of this thing. In order to do that, from time to time, the State Department, working with the Defense Department, would change the rules of war. Instead of just bombing everything over there, specifically the time that I was over there, it was decided that we would not bomb North Vietnam for several months. This was to try to induce the North Vietnamese to sit down and start talking. Believe me, we had bombed the North a lot. There were no bridges standing, et cetera, et cetera. What they had resorted to doing to reinforce the Viet Cong in South Vietnam, as well as bring in North Vietnamese regulars, was to go to their neighbor to the west, which is the country of Laos. What the North Vietnamese did was, instead of risking coming down Highway 1, which is along the coast, they went into the jungles between North Vietnam and Laos and resupplied their troops coming in that way. Laos, as Lynn told you, was a neutral country. Nobody's supposed to be fighting there. They weren't supposed to be fighting there. We weren't supposed to be fighting there. I knew nothing of this when I left the United States and headed towards Vietnam. Politically naive, I would say that all 22 pilots in my squadron, with the exception of perhaps the most senior officers in the squadron, were very politically naive. It wasn't our job to be politically astute. We were 24 years old. We'd spent 2 years of our lives learning to fly these airplanes. So this is a model of an A-7B Corsair II. It was the Navy's newest attack fighter bomber at the time. This plane was designed to put targets, to put bombs directly on targets. Close air support was one of its missions. In close to the fuselage, you will see two bombs that are larger than the others. The smaller bombs out here are 500-pound bombs, conventional weapons. We would drop those. And these could be either fuel tanks about that size, or they could be 1,000-pound bombs. Cluster bombs were tucked inside of these. The rules of the engagements were the Enterprise plus two other carriers. We had three carriers rotating in and out of there all the time. There were always three carriers in or near Yankee Station. So our missions would be to fly from Yankee Station about 100 miles and then cut across South Vietnam and up into Laos. And if you want to look at this later, you can see little circles and so forth, and those are sort of the concentrated areas where we found targets. We didn't find them. They were found for us by forward air controllers, and we would show up, and they would mark where the suspected truck parts were, trucks, convoys, munitions, hidden in the jungle in the daytime, and then in the nighttime, they'd come out and start moving them around. Experience of being a naval aviator was wonderful. I got to live the dream. I flew for 6 years. I flew all kinds of airplanes, the A-7, the A-4, and then I instructed for a couple of years. Got to fly these beautiful airplanes, which was my dream. I don't fly anymore. Let's say that I became slowly politically involved and politically aware only after I started, my family was out of the Navy. And then with things like meeting Lynn and her story, obviously it had a real resonance with me, and I wanted to see what was going on. I'll tell you just a little bit about this cluster bomb. If you looked at the bottom of that airplane and saw what it looked like just an ordinary 1,000-pound bomb, the big one under there. That's all that we didn't know too much about these. We were not really briefed in the States before we left. We knew about every other munition and every other system on that airplane, which leads me to believe that it was sort of a last-minute thing to decide to put some of these things on A-7s. A lot of them were dropped by B-52s. They called it carpet bombing, and they were all over the place. When they gave them to us, they knew exactly where they were going to end up because we were designed to put it on a specific target. I very seldom saw the target. It was usually a flare that had been dropped at night, and we would drop right on the flare and then get out of there in a hurry. There was 1 month when I can tell by my logbook, when we dropped quite a few of these things. And it was just before then that we were called in for a briefing and told what we'd be dropping. We really didn't understand what it was. I didn't realize that these guys were going to hang around for a long time. I thought they'd be there, either go off right away or maybe be around for a week or two, and then they would self-destruct. We just, again, weren't really told the longevity of these things, which is where the problem is. If they'd been gone in a couple of weeks, fine. A couple of years later, it wasn't a war zone anymore, and we're back to neutral. The insidious thing is that they're still there, and by the tens of thousands. A little happier note was the fact that my wife and I had volunteered with an organization called Global Volunteers, and we taught with them as volunteers in Mexico, Spain, the Caribbean, and had planned to go to Vietnam. And then my wife died. But a couple years later, I decided I think I better go do that. And I was a little concerned about it, but when I got there, I was welcomed graciously by the Vietnamese and the Laotians. I taught in Vietnam for about 3 weeks and then took a side trip and went up into Laos and explored all around as best I could, and just found the people to be warm, happy to see us. Thank you for listening. I hope it wasn't too disjointed. I had several different cuts on the way I could have presented this subject to you, and it was basically just to give you a chance to understand how could this come about. Well, it could come about because of a guy that loved to fly airplanes and was an instrument in this whole process. Thank you.
This is Mike Burton, and Mike Burton was also involved.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, Patrick. My name is Mike Burton. I'm a retired Air Force officer, and I was assigned during this secret war in a little place called Nakhon Phanom, which you'll see on that map, with the 56th Air Commando Group. I'd gone through all of these are now called Special Operations Units. In those days, they called us Air Commandos. I got there in 1966, the end of 1966. I was there through 1967 and part of 1968. Part of my job was to make sure that the war remained secret. That was part of it. Literally, I was one of the people that probably didn't go through his stuff because that was the Navy. But we had to redact everything, frag orders, awards, decorations, and make sure it didn't mention Laos because that was the way it was. But I got a little more personally involved because one of the other jobs I had, I acted as a liaison with Hmong troop villages that were in Laos at that time. So I was in country for off and on for those two and a half years. And my job was to act to help the village, local villagers, to find out what they needed from us and try to keep them, make sure that the supplies got to them. There was really two wars going on in Laos. There was the war should be called the Second Indochina War. That's how expansive it is. You mentioned the French, and then we just picked up after that. We started bombing over there in our units in 1965. It went on until 1975 when we finally gave up and pulled out of there. But during that time, there was a civil war. As we mentioned, they had the Pathet Lao and the PLO, the Stephan troops that were there. What the 1962 Geneva Accord, we didn't sign, U.S. did not sign the 1954 Accord. We signed a 1962 accord. That accord said that we would not have any ground troops in Laos, that nobody would have ground troops, and that the attempt was to try to get the North Vietnamese out of Laos, which they didn't leave because they found a supply train to fight their war in the south. However, that didn't say we couldn't fly, and so we continued to have air missions, but no ground missions. In fact, the CIA and the U.S. bought the best army they could, and most of those troops were Lao, some Mao, and we armed them. General Bang Pao was the head of that side of the army. I met with him several times over there to try to fight against either the North Vietnamese or the Pathet Lao. That was successful as long as we had air raids. Our groups, we were coming from further west than Patrick's group because we were on land, could fly in missions at night. I was well aware within 2 weeks of being over there that we were in a war. It wasn't a secret about it. As far as I'm concerned, it was the worst-kept secret of the world, that it was extremely destructive, that the weapons we were using were effective to some extent, but not really, because you're in a high jungle area. You can't, coming down in an A7, I can't imagine what it would be like you're not going to be very effective, quite frankly. The planes we were flying were recip aircraft. They pulled out a bunch of World War II aircraft, A-26s, T-28s, A-1s, which were slow, stable platforms that could fly low and slow on the trail and technically pinpoint. But one of the problems, again, as you mentioned, was we were dropping these cluster bombs that everybody else was dropping, and they weren't really effective because they weren't target specific. They were just mass areas. And a lot of times, I don't know if it's happened with you, but a lot of times you don't want to fly back with ordnance on your aircraft. You don't want to land with all that stuff out there. You don't know if some of it's been released or not, particularly, I assume, on an aircraft carrier. So they dump them. Now, the Navy probably dumped them in the ocean. But the Air Force units, our units, just simply dropped them in areas where we thought away from what they called safe zones. Those safe zones up there, there was about, at any given time, almost 1,000, 800 to 1,000 STOL sites, LEMA sites we call them, which were short landing strips that you would go in and take. That was part of my job, is trying to make certain that those landing strips were kept in friendly hands, but they would turn over about once a week. You never knew. You'd go down and look at those maps and you'd say, that's a safe landing strip. Today it is, and wasn't the next day, because they would change hands. So that was the kind of war that was going on. We pulled out in 1975. My old boss, General Adderholt, was responsible for trying to get some of the Hmong out of, it was primarily Hmong, out of Laos, because we simply dropped them. There were 35,000 people that we managed to get out and about twice as many that we left there. And those people started coming out through refugee camps in Thailand. Some amazing stories about how those people got out. I was back in Portland by that time. I met a guy, a lot of the Hmongs particularly, there's a large Hmong community here in Portland. I don't see anybody here tonight, but there's a large, very effective community. These people came. If you think of this, how would you like to get dropped in Laos in the middle of one of those villages you saw without maybe speaking very much Lao and say, here, start making a living. Get by. Send your kids to school. And it's an amazing story to me that these people who are here have done so well. I know doctors, lawyers, they had some struggles with their kids and this sort of thing, but it is an amazing group of people that are over here. They're I've been to too many funerals lately because a lot of these guys are dying, going to be my age. You know, they talk about recouping their country economically. At first, there was a lot of tension. The Laos here wanted to go back and kick the Pathet Lao out. You know, the Pathet Lao government, the communist government, finally in 1995, began to loosen up access to the country. I went over there shortly after that. It wasn't a very friendly visit at that time. I don't know how it is over there now. I've been a year ago, and it wasn't good either, as far as I'm concerned. But the people don't. It isn't the people. To me, sometimes it's the government. So there's some tension between the local Hmong here and the government over there. But nonetheless, as the generations are getting older, they really want to know about their culture, their people, they preserve it, and they're very concerned about how Laos is going to operate economically. Because the bombs are extremely destructive. You can see what happens. You can imagine all those little signals you saw on that map, all those little red spots. And you know, and they're happy because it's now reduced to 100 a year getting injured from 300 a year as it used to be. I mean, there's some progress, but there's still 80 million bombies laying around in Laos. And that means part of their country isn't available to them. And Laos is a landlocked agricultural place. They're right now almost a client state of the Vietnamese, who are coming in and finding labor and getting some things going. The U.S. has never paid a whole lot of attention to Laos because why? You know, I mean, it's sort of like Afghanistan. What the hell are we doing there? The important thing is to get people to focus on the fact that we left that mess behind, that it is creating difficulty for them to have work, and certainly physical injuries. So, you know, if each one of you went home and talked to two or three other people, because there's a lot of people still don't know about the secret war. It's not the war anymore. It's, you know, we're still fighting it in the sense of trying to make it right. And I've been there, seen it, and some of you have too. And the Vietnamese, the Laotian people are wonderful people. I'm particularly fond of the Hmong for their help people. But that doesn't mean everybody there, because as I said, 46 ethnic groups over there, they're wonderful people. And they want simply to live. The worst thing that happened to me was at a village I was at, and having chicken. They used to, when I came into the village, they'd kill a couple of chickens, and I won't tell you how they fix them, but I was saying the headmaster there was a teacher. That's where a lot of they do this. We got into a conversation. My Lala isn't very good, but he said, I said, what do you need? He said, I need you to leave us alone. Go away, because you're going to cause us to all die. And 2 weeks later, he was killed. You know, that's when it strikes you that this isn't fun and games. So, that's John's about it. Anyway, so thank you for what you're doing.
Hi, I'm Molly from Handicap International US, and thanks so much to our great speakers. But Handicap International has worked in Laos since 1983, and we have a team of about 150 D-miners working there to clear these weapons. Unfortunately, it'll probably take another 50 to 90 years to clear those weapons. So the U.S. is the largest funder of mine action. And when I say mine, I mean landmines, cluster bombs, and other type of weapons pollution. So they gave Lao $14 million this year, but during the war they spent on average $17 million a day on bombing, so it still falls really far short of the need. So HI, one of the things that we do is advocate for treaties that ban the use of weapons, landmines, and cluster munitions. The landmine treaty is a lot farther along. So most countries, I think, in the Western Hemisphere have signed the treaty, except for Haiti and the United States, and then some of our other friends are Syria, Iran, China, Russia. So the treaty we're trying to push forward the most right now is a landmine ban treaty, because the U.S. hasn't used landmines since 1991. We still have some in the DMZ between North and South Korea. But if you could do one thing to help us, there's some paper back there. We're collecting signatures, which we, being in D.C., we get to hand deliver our signatures to the Capitol on a regular basis. So, and Lynn and other ban advocates help us with that by attending meetings, Lynn will get to come to Washington and meet, yes, and meet with some of our friends on Capitol Hill and have conversations with them. Then, of course, the Cluster Munitions Convention, that has a lot fewer country signatories on it. The U.S. is a lot farther away from stepping back from those weapons. We last used them in Iraq, but we're still manufacturing them. So a number of U.S. companies still manufacture them, including Boeing, and we're selling them to other countries right now. One of the countries that's using them the most right now is Syria. My organization does a lot of work with refugees from there, but we're planning for whenever this conflict ends to do a huge clearance operation there, and that will, we don't even know what to expect there. It'll be decades and decades, we imagine. If you'd like to support the work in Laos, demining and support to victims, and also risk education, our group goes to schools and other communities to educate people about the dangers of the weapons. Especially kids still collect scrap metal, including bombs, and a lot of them don't know about the dangers of it. So the link is bit.ly/banadvocates. Thanks a lot for coming out tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a panel discussion on landmines and the history of landmines in the country of Laos. The discussion was recorded at the First United Methodist Church in Portland last Thursday. The website for Handicap International is www.handicap-international.us. Stay tuned now for noon headlines, followed by the noontime jamboree. It's 30 seconds before noon, and you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland.
And now, the KBOO News at Noon for August 25th, 2014. Egyptian officials have proposed new ceasefire terms to try to bring an end to the six-week-long Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. This weekend, Israeli officials admitted that they wrongly accused Hamas of breaking the last ceasefire hours before its scheduled end in order to justify their attempted assassination by missile of a Hamas leader. The missile ended up killing the Hamas leader's wife and baby instead. Over the weekend, Israeli airstrikes killed 32 Palestinians, including a mother and her four children, who were killed while sleeping in their beds. Five other children under age 10 were among those killed by Israeli airstrikes this weekend, including a one-year-old baby. The Islamic group known as the Dawn of Libya overwhelmed the city of Tripoli on Sunday. After nearly a month of clashes with government-funded militias, the group has taken control of the capital's international airport and much of the city. Intense fighting and shelling has prompted the closure of embassies and forced thousands to flee the city. Multiple cases of Ebola have been confirmed in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Two of eight patients tested in the country's northern province were found positive for the virus. Officials believe Ebola has killed 13 other people in the region. Health Minister Felix Kabange Numbi denies any link between the outbreak and the epidemic in West Africa. The Congo is now the fifth country in Africa with confirmed cases of the virus. Today, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit to force Oklahoma prisons to allow all witnesses to watch executions from beginning to end.